This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 2nd of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, in Bahrain, the regime lifts emergency law, but the violent crackdown on teachers, doctors, lawyers, and activists continues. Japan's Prime Minister survives a no-confidence vote in the wake of the country's ongoing nuclear disaster.
For Japan, it's not time to play game with politics.
And we talk to a Bangladeshi garment worker who's been targeted for her activism. She'll be attending Walmart's annual shareholders meeting tomorrow in Arkansas to ask the company to protect workers' rights.
The workers are getting poverty wage. They do not have voice in their workplaces. And Walmart, of course, can act to make the changes there.
Those stories and more. But first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. An international commission looking at worldwide drug policy effectiveness has concluded that so-called drug wars across the globe have failed. The Global Commission on Drug Policy is a group composed largely of former high-ranking government officials, ex-presidents, and other civil society members. The group is calling on world governments to break the taboo on drug policy debate and reform and to treat addiction as a health rather than criminal issue. It's advocating for the application of, quote, human rights and harm reduction principles to users and those at the lower end of production and distribution, like farmers and small-time drug sellers. The commission says the policy of incarceration has not reduced access to illegal drugs and should be reformed. The group also recommends that governments legalize and regulate cannabis. The discrepancy in sentencing for users of crack and cocaine was in part fixed by Congress last year, but now the federal body that formulates sentencing guidelines is considering applying the new law to inmates convicted before the legislative change was made. Speaking at a hearing yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder voiced qualified support for the idea. For FSRN, Darby Hickey has more from Washington, D.C.
For the past 25 years, a person convicted of possessing 5 grams of crack cocaine was subject to the same mandatory minimum prison term as an individual sentenced for having 500 grams of cocaine in its powder form. Prison reform advocates decried the law because a disproportionate number of minorities were arrested for possession of crack cocaine. Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act last summer to address this disparity. Wednesday, the U.S. Sentencing Commission heard testimony on the possibility of applying that change retroactively. During testimony, Attorney General Eric Holder urged a limited application of the new law to those previously sentenced. Holder suggested that certain violent inmates and repeat offenders should be ineligible to apply for sentence reductions. But House Judiciary Chairman Lamar Smith said the Attorney General's position amounted to being, quote, more concerned for the well-being of criminals than the safety of our communities. Advocacy groups, such as Families Against Mandatory Minimums, said the administration's proposal did not go far enough. Retroactive application of the law could affect more than 12,000 federal inmates, the vast majority of whom are African American. Darby Hickey, FSRN, Washington.
Food is running out fast in the Libyan port city of Misrata, according to the World Food Program, which delivered food aid to thousands of people yesterday. It's the fourth time the WFP has sent food to Misrata for civilians trapped in the fighting between government and opposition forces. UN Radio's Jocelyn Sambiro reports.
A ship carrying food aid from the World Food Program arrived in Misrata on Wednesday. The ship is delivering more than 420 metric tons of food, enough to feed 25 people for 1 month. The agency says it's concerned about the dwindling food supplies in war-torn Libya. WFP has hired another vessel of food to reach the besieged city of Misrata in the coming days. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
More people are dead in the Syrian town of Rostan today as government security forces continue their assault on the opposition stronghold. Several news outlets are reporting the number of dead to be 15 in the past day and nearly 60 since the attack began this weekend. The U.S. appeared to strengthen its stance on Syria today. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told reporters that the international community needed to show a united front in condemning the violence. Russia has been a holdout on the U.N. Security Council, trying to block such resolutions. Clinton also added that President Assad and the current government's legitimacy had, quote, nearly run out. A coalition of housing groups is suing a major developer for violating the Fair Housing Act in its Florida properties. The National Fair Housing Alliance and the West Palm Beach Coalition for Independent Living Options says that dozens of properties developed by the Cornerstone Group do not provide adequate access for people with disabilities. Shanna Smith, president of the Fair Housing Alliance, said these protections went into effect in 1991.
And now we're 20 years later, and we're still finding developers, architects, builders who continue to construct and design properties where people with disabilities, particularly people who use wheelchairs, can't even get into the units, or they can't maneuver through those units.
Smith says Cornerstone is one of the 10 largest multifamily housing developers in the country and has received state and federal subsidies for their projects. The housing advocates say they investigated 26 sites in Florida and identified barriers like steps and high thresholds at every property. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Following the lifting of emergency law in Bahrain, security forces continue to attack protesters in villages near the capital, Manama. Authorities imposed emergency law in mid-March in response to pro-democracy rallies. Since then, security forces and Saudi troops have targeted teachers, doctors, lawyers, and activists. In this video posted to YouTube that says it's from a protest yesterday in Bilad al-Qadim, a suburb of the capital, hundreds of protesters walk through the streets before suddenly fleeing after an attack, presumably by security forces. About 30 have been killed, hundreds injured, and more than 1,000 arrested over the last few months, according to Human Rights Watch. Bahrain's Youth Society for Human Rights says despite the lifting of martial law, today seven people were sentenced for terms of up to 5 years in jail for taking part in protests and disrupting public order. Meanwhile, the Bahrain Center for Human Rights says the trial of rights defender Abdelhadi Al-Khawaja in a military court is in its final stages. Khawaja was detained in April and is among about 20 other people arrested on charges that include managing a terrorist organization. But his supporters say he was only expressing freedom of speech, and Khawaja's family says he's been tortured while in custody, including attempted rape. Bahraini authorities are hoping to convince race car officials who are meeting in Barcelona tomorrow to go ahead with a Grand Prix in the country later this year. An earlier race was cancelled because of the unrest. Today in Japan, Prime Minister Naoto Kan survived a motion for a no-confidence vote in Parliament. Lawmakers had called for the removal of the widely unpopular Prime Minister, who's been in office only 1 year. Parliament defeated the motion by a vote of 293 to 152. As FSRN's Dolores M. Bernal reports, many Japanese don't think right now is the time for a change in leadership, especially since problems still continue at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant.
About an hour before the Japanese parliament considered a no-confidence vote, Prime Minister Naoto Kan went on television and promised the Japanese people that he would step down after progress was made in the areas affected by the March 11 earthquake and tsunami, which includes the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. In his speech, Kan said he will step down from his post and, quote, hand over the various responsibilities to a younger generation. His speech may have persuaded some of his peers to vote against the no-confidence motion, and the Prime Minister will keep his job. This was Kan's closest call to lose his post since he took office last June. Members of the opposition party led the motion to remove him. They claim that Kan has failed to turn the economy around and is incapable of finding a fiscal solution to the growing national debt.
For Japan, it's not time to play game with politics.
Takahiro Kimura works in the Japanese government and believes that the motion to remove Kan is a distraction to the work at hand.
It's time to help the people affected by the disaster in Tohoku area.
And Kimura's not alone. Toru Atobe is a Japanese writer whose parents live in Sendai, one of the worst-affected areas of the earthquake and tsunami. He was frustrated with the motion to remove Kan during this time of crisis.
It's very important time to improve our crisis, but it's only for politicians' benefit. It's not our benefit, and it wastes time.
The March 11 earthquake and tsunami left more than 15,000 people confirmed dead. More than 8,400 are still missing. Property damage estimates are close to $34 billion. Meanwhile, the work continues at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, where challenges plague the workers who are still trying to pump water out of their reactors and restore cooling functions. No one is really sure how many more months it will take to bring the situation under total control. Many Japanese believe that Kan's lack of leadership has something to do with how the nuclear crisis in Fukushima was managed.
I think he should resign.
Ayumi Nakayama is another Japanese who feels unhappy with Kan. She thinks the Japanese government is broken after seeing five prime ministers come and go since 2006.
Every time, nothing changed. Every time, the same thing. Nobody have new ideas.
Prime Minister Kan didn't give a timeline of how much longer he plans to stay in office, but progress has indeed taken place in the earthquake-affected areas, according to Kimura.
It looks like the reconstruction have been really well, especially in the lifeline, like water and electricity and gas. The structure supply have been restored already, so maybe infrastructure will be restored at full scale soon.
Former Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama, who resigned prior to Kan taking over, has stated that perhaps Kan will step down as soon as the end of this month, after the supplementary budget, which contains money for the reconstruction, is approved by Parliament. When Kan vacates his post, a new Prime Minister will have to be selected. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Tokyo.
The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, is holding its annual shareholders meeting tomorrow in Arkansas. Shareholders will be hearing a proposal from Kalpona Akder from the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, who worked for one of Walmart's garment suppliers in Bangladesh and is now campaigning on behalf of its workers for better working conditions and a livable wage. With support from New York City pension funds, which owns shares in Walmart, Akder will be asking shareholders to approve a measure that would require the company's suppliers to publish reports detailing working conditions in their factories. Walmart is one of the biggest buyers of clothes made in Bangladesh. But the International Labour Rights Forum says workers in Bangladesh have the lowest wages and some of the worst working conditions in the region. Workers' rights are also often repressed. For her campaigning, Akder herself and a colleague were held in jail and are facing what they say are false charges that include destroying property at a Walmart supplier. They could face life imprisonment or even execution. About 100,000 consumers have signed a petition organized by the International Labour Rights Forum calling for Walmart to apply pressure to get the charges dropped. Kalpona Akder joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Can you tell us about the factory that you worked at? What did you do and what were the conditions like for you and your co-workers?
When I started to work, I was just 12 years old. So the working condition was bad during that time. It was like end of 88. We had to work long working shift, like 14 to 15 hours and sometime overnight. Like I'm experienced working 23 days in a row and having like few hours, 2-3 hours to sleeping in the production floor. And my shift used to start 8 a.m. in the following morning. So this was the working condition. And we when I used to work, I would pay $6 per month for 208-hour work. We used to be abused by the mid-level management, like my supervisors and line chiefs and production manager. They used to slap on our faces, push by neck when we used to do a minor mistake. And we hadn't any voice in our workplace. like right to form union, right to organize, and right to bargain.
Was there one particular incident that made you decide you should join up with the Center for Worker Solidarity?
Yeah, the particular one was in 1994, we had a strike in my factory because the management wanted to pay less than what they used to pay for our overtime hours. So then we went for a strike. And for that strike, 20 of my co-workers lost their jobs. And during that time, we hadn't any idea about the labor law and rights. So after that, we found an organization who are giving access to workers to learn labor law. So then we went there, and I have learned labor law. So that really inspired me to join the labor union and later Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity.
Last year, Bangladesh garment workers were involved in deadly protests about their wages. This did force the government to raise the minimum wage. How much are workers making now, and is it enough?
Yeah, it's a really great question that you have raised. Yeah. Last year, across the country, there was a protest from the workers, and they were demanding $71 per month for 208-hour work, while they were getting only $23 per month. So factory owners and the government has been increased it up to $42 after a lot of protests, a lot of workers firing from the factory, and many cases has been filed against the labor leaders, including us. So after that, what they are getting is $42, and definitely it's not enough for their living cost.
The garment sector is a significant part of the Bangladeshi economy, and Walmart is one of the biggest purchasers of clothing. Tell us about the company's influence in the country.
Walmart's influence in Bangladesh is huge because they are one of the largest buyers for the Bangladesh, and they are buying like 12 to 15% of our clothes that we make. They can do or they can act more. What they are doing, it is not enough. I think they can do more to implement the worker rights or treating them well.
Following last year's demonstrations, you and several other labor leaders were arrested, jailed, and charged with criminal wrongdoing. What exactly are the charges you're facing?
The charge says that we have been provocated workers to do the strike in the factory, demand the minimum wage, and come to the street and do the vandalizing. And also, maybe during that chaos, there were some explosive device has been blasted. We even don't know where it is. And among those 11 cases, 4 has been filed by Walmart's subcontractor supplier factory in Bangladesh. And they really can act strongly to drop the charges against us. Because if this goes to trial and we'll convict for lifetime imprisonment, or maybe the possibility for death penalty.
That's astonishing that you could be facing the death penalty. And now you're in the United States and you'll be going to the Walmart shareholders meeting later this week. What will you ask Walmart shareholders to do?
I'm going to represent the pension fund. Basically, they have invested to the Walmart, which is $300 million. So I'm going to talk on behalf of them. Well, I'm bringing a proposal where they will say that there should be a sustainable report from the vendors, not only from the Walmart. So then that it will be make clear what is the working condition there. This is one part. And second is I also talk about what is the reality in the Walmart factories in back home. Like the workers are getting poverty wage. They do not have voice in their workplaces. And Walmart, of course, can act more to make the changes there. And they also can take a strong part to drop the charges against us.
How do you feel about presenting this to the shareholders? Are you nervous, perhaps, or are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, first of all, it is very new for me. And secondly, I'm really honored. I'm not sure that the shareholders will vote for this, but it's a great, great opportunity to at least tell them in front of them that this is the reality. And I'm also really thankful to the New York Comptroller Office. They thought about it because the money they are investing, at least they thought that this money should not be repressed the workers like Bangladesh or China or Haiti.
Kalpona Akhtar from the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity, good luck with your campaign and thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
A group of progressives in the US House released a report today called Freedom from Oil that highlights practical ways for communities to save money while also improving their local environments. Matt Laszlo has the details.
Most every side of the debate agrees that climate change legislation is a non-starter in this Congress, but that doesn't mean smaller efforts to reduce carbon emissions and improve local communities are all doomed. Oregon Democratic Congressperson Earl Blumenauer is the head of the Livable Communities Task Force. He says lawmakers in Washington are playing politics with energy policy instead of becoming a part of a growing movement to make communities less dependent on fossil fuels.
Once you get outside the Beltway, it's not particularly controversial. It is being put in place here in Washington, D.C., across the river in Arlington, in Madison, Wisconsin, in New Mexico, in California. People are moving in this direction.
The ideas highlighted in the report range from accelerating the increase of fuel efficiency standards, which could save drivers more than a dollar a gallon, to letting consumers pay less if they drive less, which would promote keeping the car in the driveway. Blumenauer says energy policy is too short-sighted.
Too much of America is dependent on a pattern that imagines that we will always have an unlimited supply of inexpensive gasoline. And government policies in housing and road transportation reinforce that.
Those policies are unlikely to change anytime soon. With gas prices as high as they've been, lately Republicans have been calling for increased domestic oil production. Here's Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso.
Unrest in the Middle East and a weak dollar is driving oil prices even higher. Now, more than ever, we must produce more American energy. We need to do this to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And Americans are looking to Washington for leadership.
On Wednesday, Louisiana Republican Senator David Vitter released a hold he had on the president's nominee to head the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Vitter's problem wasn't the nominee. Rather, he said he wanted 15 new drilling permits in the Gulf of Mexico before he'd allow the nominee to move forward. Last month, Vitter said the administration was blocking the U.S. from its own energy supplies by increasing environmental regulations after last year's devastating Gulf oil spill.
It's virtually shut down the Gulf, produced less energy, and thrown a lot of Louisianians and Americans out of work. We need to streamline that process. We need to accelerate that process, not add any new burdens and any new hurdles in it.
But many dispute these claims, including California Democratic Congressperson Lois Capps.
The fact is that the Republican majority is deluding the public into believing that more offshore drilling permits is going to be a quick fix to the existing high oil prices, gas prices. But here's the harsh reality. The United States is never going to have control over world oil supplies or gas prices through drilling.
That's why this group of Democrats is pushing what they call more practical and more immediate ways to curb oil dependency, such as building condos and low-income housing near transit hubs, and to get local city planners to incorporate non-carbon-based transit. Rob Healy is with the American Public Transit Association.
Really, I think one of the easiest ways for Americans to avoid the current high price of fuel is to use public transportation.
Healy says instead of making it easier for people to use public transportation, many locales have actually done the opposite.
Public transit agencies over the last year actually reducing service by 47% of the agencies have had to cut service. Many of them have had to raise fares. And, you know, this is exactly the wrong time to be doing that.
These lawmakers on the Livable Communities Task Force know they face an uphill battle in this Congress, but they say their focus now is educating local leaders to carry through with ideas to trim costs while also cutting oil dependency. They say a ground-up approach of getting local leaders to take the lead may be one of their only options. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
The New York Police Department is facing scrutiny over revelations that over the first 3 months of 2011, officers stopped and interrogated more than 150,000 people and did not charge them with a crime. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr brings us more.
Of the more than 183,000 stop and frisks made between January and March, more than 80% targeted blacks and Latinos. Nearly 90% did not lead to arrest or a court summons. 23-year-old college student Domingo Estevez says he is routinely stopped by police in his predominantly Hispanic neighborhood of Washington Heights. Estevez says police have stopped him simply walking down the street or taking the subway, accusing him of smelling like marijuana.
Every time I'm driving a car, when I'm hanging around with my friends, it just gives them a reason basically to just stop us and, well, racial profiling. It seems like it's legal nowadays, you know.
According to the data released last weekend, in East New York's 73rd precinct, more than 1,300 blacks were stopped or frisked for so-called furtive movements, compared to just 18 whites. An additional 85 blacks, but only 2 whites, were frisked for wearing attire inappropriate for season, and more than 300 blacks were stopped for the vague category of other, compared to just 5 whites. Hispanics were also stopped and frisked in these categories more frequently than whites. The police department denies the charge of profiling based on race, but Estevez says such tactics further criminalize already marginalized communities.
Well, I was a criminal justice major. I could tell you from what I learned in criminology that the whole criminal justice system is made for individuals to feel that the people around them, just because they're facing poverty or impoverished situations, that they're more likely to commit crimes than anybody else can. You understand? So you go in there with the mentality of hating your surroundings.
The city is required to release the stop and frisk data as a result of a multi-year legal campaign by civil rights groups. Advocates maintain these stops occur without reasonable cause and target people of color, thus violating the 4th and 14th Amendments. Darius Charney, a lawyer with the legal advocacy group, the Center for Constitutional Rights, says such tactics are counterproductive to crime fighting.
And, you know, you got to keep in mind that this is during a time where crime has either gone down or essentially stayed flat. So it's not as if, you know, there's an outbreak of crime that would cause, you know, more aggressive policing practices. So it really is, it's out of control. And it's also really not accomplishing what the police department says it uses it for.
The stops from the first 3 months of this year has already topped the more than 86,000 made in all of 2001 and puts the NYPD on pace to stop and frisk more than 700,000 New Yorkers this year. Jessel Knorr, FSRN, New York.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.